From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. On this special edition of our broadcast, an extended interview with former Weather Underground activist and current education reformer Bill Ayers. In his new memoir, Public Enemy, he talks about his life on the run as an accused domestic terrorist.
I was recognized on the street 3 or 4 times a month. No one wanted to turn me in. No one decided it was a good idea to call the police.
Also, his times in Chicago with Barack Obama and his view of the president today.
Too many people on the left, too many progressives, are deeply, deeply disappointed with President Obama. But all I can say is they weren't paying attention. All through the 2008 campaign and going back before that.
That's our extended interview with Bill Ayers. It's coming up after our summary of the day's main news.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Elena Kassas. 3 Ukrainian opposition leaders have signed a deal with President Viktor Yanukovych aimed at finding a way out of the political crisis. Parliament has voted to restore the 2004 constitution, taking power away from the president, and approved an amnesty for all protesters involved in violence. The deal sets a 10-day deadline for the formation of a coalition caretaker government and promises elections no later than December. It also promises an investigation into the recent violence. But for some of the opposition, it may not be enough. Protesters have reportedly marched on Parliament to show their disapproval. Telegraph correspondent Roland Oliphant in Kiev says many of those camped out in Independence Square say they will reject any deal that falls short of Yanukovych's immediate resignation.
As far as we know, there have been talks about preterm elections, early presidential elections, that is, which have been a key demand of the protesters ever since December. No one on the square believes anything the president says. They're waiting and seeing. I would add that also people are determined, but they're not going anywhere until Yanukovych goes now.
There are also fears the Yanukovych government could renege on its part of the agreement and worries the December election date is just too far away. 3 EU foreign ministers brokered the deal overnight and the union imposed sanctions on Ukraine on Wednesday to try to increase the pressure. The US earlier issued visa bans targeting 20 named individuals. But as analyst Matthew Rajonsky of the Kenan Institute explained to the PBS NewsHour, foreign powers may have little leverage to hold Ukraine to the agreement.
My concern here is we're stuck between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, we are trying to impose sanctions on people who more or less feel that their lives are at stake, their political survival. Ukraine's not a country where you leave political office, you give up wealth and power, and you're fine. Look at Yulia Tymoshenko, right? So if these people's backs are against the wall, telling them you can't vacation in Florida, the south of France, we're going to freeze your assets, it just may not be enough. It may be a few grains of sand on one end of a scale. It doesn't change the balance for them. On the other hand, if we escalate sanctions, if we go after Ukrainian businesses, which are owned by the so-called oligarchs, the kingmakers in Ukraine, the results of that could be very unpredictable. Bringing these powerful forces into the fight more directly, we don't know how that will end. It could mean widening violence in the country.
U.S. President Barack Obama is to host the Dalai Lama at the White House on Friday, despite urging from China to cancel the meeting. China says the U.S. is interfering with its internal affairs. The White House says the Dalai Lama has been invited in his capacity as an internationally respected religious leader. The two last met in 2011 in talks that angered Beijing. The US says it does not support Tibetan independence, but is concerned about the deteriorating human rights situation in Tibet. From bureaus around the world, this is FSN. The Venezuelan government has sent a battalion of paratroopers to the eastern city of San Cristobal in an increasingly heavy-handed crackdown on opposition demonstrators. At least 6 people have been killed in 2 weeks of protests across Venezuela. The opposition says the army and loyalist militias have opened fire on protesters, while the government blames demonstrators for the violence. Top Iranian officials meeting with Western negotiators in Vienna say they've agreed to a framework to move forward on negotiations for a comprehensive deal on Iran's nuclear program. These talks mark the start of a complicated process expected to take around 6 months. The US says, thanks in part to the constructive and useful discussions, there now appears to be a path forward. Our Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff has more.
The Iranians credited the positive atmosphere in Vienna for allowing the crafting of a framework and plan of action for comprehensive nuclear talks. The U.S. confirmed there is a path forward, but officials involved are not talking details, saying the deal will not be negotiated in public. The U.S. is convinced this will be a complicated, difficult, and lengthy process, but they want to get a deal completed with Iran within 6 months. For the Obama administration, they feel the time for political grandstanding is over. It's about taking a workmanlike approach to the basic goal of ensuring Iran does not have military dimensions to its program and is not and will not obtain a nuclear weapon. The next round of talks is planned for March 17th in Vienna. Priscilla Huff, Washington.
And in London, former News of the World editor Rebecca Brooks has told her phone hacking trial she did not have a six-year affair with colleague Andy Coulson. Brooks and Coulson, who succeeded her at the paper, both face a string of charges related to hacking voicemails. Earlier, Brooks denied all knowledge of private investigator Glenn Mulcair's contract with the paper. That's the latest from Feature Story News. Elena Casas reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. Now, cast your mind back, if you can, to October the 6th, 2008, and a moment in that year's presidential election campaign when Republican vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin launched a fresh salvo against the man who went on to win the election, then U.S. Senator Barack Obama.
Our opponent is someone who sees America as imperfect enough to pal around with terrorists who targeted their own country. One of his earliest supporters is a man who, according to the New York Times, was a domestic terrorist and part of a group that, quote, launched a campaign of bombings that would target the Pentagon and the U.S. Capitol.
Palling around with terrorists, it became a Republican mantra to describe Barack Obama's relationship, acquaintanceship might be a better word, with former Weather Underground activist and education reformer Bill Ayers. Today, on this special edition of FSN Reports, we talk to Bill Ayers. He's written a new book called Public Enemy: Confessions of an American Dissident. And in this extended interview, he talks with FSN's Daniel Wrenches.
I was a leader of the student movement, Students for a Democratic Society, and we were deeply involved in the civil rights movement in the 1960s and the effort against the war in Vietnam. And I was first arrested, actually, opposing the war in Vietnam in 1965. I was arrested with 39 other young people, students, in a militant, nonviolent, direct action in a draft board. At that time, something like 15% of Americans opposed the war. 3 years later, over half of Americans opposed the war. And those 3 years are significant because there was a lot of anti-war organizing, but more importantly, the Black Freedom Movement, or large segments of it, came out against the war. Martin Luther King gave the famous speech where he said, "My country is the most, it perpetrates the most violence of any country on earth." He called the war in Vietnam immoral and illegal and insisted that we get out of Vietnam. That was in 1966-67. Muhammad Ali refused to fight. He said, "I won't fight in the white man's army." And he became a world figure, not for fighting, but for not fighting. So the Black movement played a big role. Also, the vets returning home. John Kerry famously testified before the U.S. Senate and said, "We commit war crimes in Vietnam every day, not as a matter of choice, but as a matter of policy." And the country shook. So by 1968, people opposed the war, and we thought we'd won a great victory. I was in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and we had a spontaneous rally when Lyndon Johnson announced that he would not rerun for president. We thought the war would end. 5 days after Johnson's announcement, King was killed. 2 months after that, Kennedy was killed, Robert Kennedy. And shortly after that, it was clear the war wouldn't end and it would drag on and on. And every week that the war went on, 6,000 people would be murdered. We didn't know how to stop it. And that was a crisis for democracy and a crisis for the anti-war movement. Out of the student movement, a group of us started a clandestine organization called the Weather Underground. And our intention was twofold. One was to survive what we took to be a growing American authoritarianism and repression. And two was to take a screaming protest against the war to the American people. And so we famously you know, set bombs in the Pentagon and several other places. We destroyed war property. We destroyed symbolic targets. We never killed or hurt anyone after our own three people killed themselves making a bomb in 1970. But that's how we became quite notorious. In this country, we're still absolutely in agony about Vietnam. And in part, it's because we've never had a process of truth and reconciliation. We've never approached the truth, and therefore it lives as a kind of a bleeding wound in our psyche.
You were on the run for 10 years. How did you manage to evade the authorities?
Well, you know, there's a technical response to that, I suppose, and then a more social political response. Technically, we were a bunch of college kids who were spending all of our intelligence and energy trying to figure out how to survive. So we figured out how to get false identities and how to, you know, how to elude the authorities and live kind of off the grid. We worked, all of us worked. I had many, many jobs. My wife, Bernadine Dorn, worked in restaurants in the cash economy. I worked as a day laborer all over the country. So that was part of the answer. But a bigger part of the answer is that I was recognized on the street many, many times, probably three or four times a month in the 10 years I was underground. No one wanted to turn me in. No one decided it was a good idea to call the police. In other words, we were part of the anti-war movement. We were fish in the sea. We were part of it. And nobody, even people who disagreed with us profoundly, thought that it would be a good idea if we went to jail. And that means we were protected by ordinary people all the time.
And in the end, you were protected when you did come out into the public eye and to the courtroom by the bungling of the initial investigation and the fact that they had to throw out all of the charges against you because of their methods.
It wasn't bungling. It's true what you said, except the charges eventually were dropped. I was on the run from two federal indictments, single count conspiracy indictments, and those are a little shady to start with because they're not charging me with doing anything. They're charging me with having a conversation about doing something. But the two indictments were crossing state lines to destroy government property and crossing state lines to foment civil disturbance. Both of those were dropped, not because of bungling, but because of gross government misconduct. Just to give you one example, the FBI had an approved plan signed by J. Edgar Hoover to kidnap my nephew, who was 2 years old, to force Bernadine Dorn and me to turn ourselves in. Now, there's not a jury in the land then, and probably not now, who would see that as reasonable kind of police work. So it was things like that. It was the misconduct of the government. It's not that they kind of made mistakes. They intentionally set out, and we learned all this in the COINTELPRO release of federal FBI files and secret government files a few years later. There was a massive government conspiracy to undermine the Black Panthers, the peace movement, and so on.
During that time, obviously, you were in the media focus. And then after, basically, you went back to a sort of normal life, your star came down a little. But then during the election campaign in which now President Obama was a then senator was debating with Hillary Clinton, then senator, your name came up again.
Well, you know, I've been a public person really my whole adult life, and I never think of my star going up or down. I act on what I think is important, and we had seen this coming, my family and I, for months, because there was a narrative developing on the right-wing kind of blogosphere. The fever swamps were crawling with this story. And the story was nobody could figure out how to oppose Obama because he was charismatic, brilliant, smart. So Hillary Clinton developed a narrative that she drove pretty far. And the narrative was, we don't know much about this senator from Illinois. He doesn't have much experience, good-looking kid. But we do know that he has some shady friends, a Black nationalist preacher, a fiery, you know, minister, a Palestinian scholar, and this guy, Bill Ayers, who's a former weatherman, an unrepentant terrorist. Hillary raised that thing, and the first person to bring it into the public, into the mass media, into the mainline media, was George Stephanopoulos during the debate in April 2008 between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And it happened that I had my seminar, my graduate students at my house. Somebody turned on the debate, and it was right when George Stephanopoulos was pressing Obama on his relationships with Jeremiah Wright. And then as people settled in to watch, Stephanopoulos said, well, besides Jeremiah Wright, what about this guy, Bill Ayers, who your campaign says you're friendly with? And he's a former weatherman, and he bombed the Pentagon. Isn't that going to be a problem for voters? And Barack Obama looked a little tongue-tied and off balance. I know I'm projecting because I felt tongue-tied and off balance, but he responded by saying, look, George, this is a guy around the neighborhood, a professor of English or something, who I know, but who I've not taken any advice from. And by the way, to charge me with detestable acts he did when I was 8 years old is ridiculous. My students exploded in laughter. Several of them fell to the floor. They couldn't believe what had just come into our living room and by extension was reverberating around the country. And one student turned to me and said, oh my God, that guy has the same name as yours. I mean, she didn't even know. And one of the other students excitedly said, that's because they're the same guy. So that's how it became kind of a mainline thing. And it was quite surreal for a while to be associated in that way.
Surreal, but also scary.
It had scary aspects and also lovely aspects. The scary part, I mean, it goes on to this day, frankly. I mean, I get threats. Part of my new book is called Talking with the Tea Party. And part of it is about this kind of campaign of demonization. I think that campaign, you know, as I say, Hillary Clinton kind of invented it. But Palin and McCain drove it to its outer limits. And Palin came up with that marvelous, deathless phrase, palling around with terrorists, which he raised at every occasion.
You have been very willing to engage in a quite open way with Tea Party activists.
Absolutely. And I think it's the essence of democracy. It's the responsibility of any engaged citizen to talk to strangers, to talk to people you don't agree with. It's a crazy idea to think you would only talk to people who you are like-minded with. So I enjoy talking to them, and I usually surprise them, and sometimes they surprise me. Yes, the Tea Party is definitely manipulated by big money from above. It's definitely a social movement that's been set in motion by people like the Koch brothers. And it's also definitely got racial undertones that are sometimes pretty obvious. But having said that, there's also a legitimate concern about government run amok, about not trusting the government. And I am right there. I mean, I find myself often kind of in agreement around this issue or that issue. Where we might differ is that I think that they have a very soft line on corporate America, which is the real rulers. I mean, the people who are really running things and pulling the strings are the greedy people at the top, the 1%. I don't think that many of the people in the Tea Party have not yet made that leap, but I think they could.
And President Obama plays golf with top executives at UBS?
Without a doubt. I mean, you know, the thing about President Obama is too many people on the left, too many progressives, too many radicals are deeply, deeply disappointed with President Obama. But all I can say is they weren't paying attention. All through the 2008 campaign and going back before that, Obama's politics have been consistent. His self-description in 2008 was moderate, middle-of-the-road, pragmatic politician. The right wing looked at that and said, no, he's a secret socialist who pals around with terrorists and has Palestinian friends. The left looked at that same statement and said, he's winking in my direction. But he wasn't winking. He is a moderate, middle-of-the-road, pragmatic politician. That means on the big issues, war and peace, we don't agree. Those of us who are on the left don't agree with the administration.
And he's a war criminal?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but I think there's an absolute case to say that this government and this president and every government going backwards, every U.S. president, should be investigated for the acts that they take that would be criminal if anybody else did them. So, for example, drone strikes. Are those illegal? They are illegal under international law. Shouldn't that be investigated? Shouldn't, you know, the Obama administration be held to account? They should. So, yes, in that sense, I mean, I can't say he's a war criminal, but I can say that that there's a case to be made for criminal activity at the top when it comes to questions of human rights abuses and war and peace. Things that we would look at any other person and say, that's a crime, that's against international standards, whether it's torture or black sites or extrajudicial assassinations. Anybody who does that is committing a crime. But when we do it, our hearts are so pure, our intentions so good that we let ourselves off the hook. We shouldn't do that.
Do you hold the same kind of perspective when it comes to the National Security Agency and the kinds of intrusions that people feel that are being brought upon them, looking at their emails, all of this kind of thing? Or do you think this is legitimate? Every country does it.
No, there's no legitimacy to it. I mean, you can't be a free person and a freedom-loving person if you accept that you're always under surveillance, you're always being counted and figured looked at. No, free people aren't under surveillance. And the fact is, when some of us were young, when I was young, 1984 was a theory and a projection and an interesting idea. 1984 is a hard reality. There's no question. You're under surveillance. I'm under surveillance all the time. The beautiful thing about Edward Snowden, who I take to be an American dissident and a hero, Edward Snowden, Chelsea Manning, Jeremy Hammond, who was sentenced to 10 years in prison this week from Anonymous. To me, what I love about those folks, WikiLeaks as well, what I love about those folks is they represent us watching them watching us. We can't stop them from watching us exactly at this moment, but we can watch them watch us. And it's marvelous to see the NSA and the national security state squirm because this one young guy is going to drop another leak this week and next week and the week after. That's a very good thing.
Let me challenge you on that idea. All nations have their own security apparatus. All nations need to spy on each other and ensure the security of their own people. This is something that if you're going to join the intelligence services, you have to accept. You can't just say, okay, well, I've made a personal judgment that all of this is wrong.
But it's not true. I mean, I don't accept the premise that all governments do it and all nations need to spy on other nations in order to stay safe. That's not the only world I can imagine living in. Just like I don't think we have to imagine living in a world that's just a swamp fight between two crocodiles. We can rise above that. We can imagine a world where we become a nation among nations and other nations adopt the same kind of standards. So recently, Snowden and Greenwald released a paper that said that the United States Intelligence Service was spying on British citizens, violating a treaty they signed in 1946 not to do that. That seems to me outrageous that they did it, but wonderful that that's now released. And the British people and the American people have to decide, is that a worthwhile thing? Is that really protecting us? Or is that crossing certain lines? Is listening to Angela Merkel's cell phones, is that really protecting us from terrorism? I don't think so. I think it's an overreach of a high order. Then you raise the question about, for example, I think you're pointing towards Snowden and saying, well, you can't just make an individual decision once you're hired. Absolutely, you can and you must. What was Nuremberg about? It was about the fact that you're responsible for your behavior, even when you're in a system whose behavior is immoral and illegal and wrong. You then have to stand up and say something. There comes a time in history, and it's coming quicker than anybody knows, but there comes a time when you have no court of last resort and you can't say, I was a good soldier, I was following orders. Your own conscience, your own compass, your own sense of humanity is called upon to do the right thing in spite of the fact that it's unconventional and illegal. I think that's what Ellsberg did. I think that's what Hammond did. And I think that's what Snowden did. Chelsea Manning, too. I think that we should applaud it and not go along with the idea of demonizing these folks and allowing them to be isolated and persecuted.
Bill, that doesn't answer the question, which is that it's legitimate for the US government and for the spy agencies to want to trawl through masses of metadata when they have a lead that a terrorist is trying to harm the US mainland or indeed somebody in Britain, where they are continuing to look for leads. And the fact of the matter is they've told us that the court procedures and the checks and balances ensure that the only way they can access all of this metadata that they've gathered in some box is to tap it when they know they have a legitimate terrorist lead.
And why do you trust them when they say, we know we have a legitimate terrorist lead? I mean, you're a reporter, you're a news person, and isn't it your job to be deeply, deeply skeptical? In fact, I encourage you to take a page from I.F. Stone, who said, as a reporter, as a young reporter like yourself, you should start off with the belief that all governments lie. All governments lie. And if you begin there, then you begin to ask the question, why do they lie? How do they lie? Who do they lie to? And try to get to the bottom of it. So I don't trust for a minute State Department releases or Defense Department releases or White House releases that were pursuing a legitimate lead. And if you look at just the last couple of years of, you know, fighting terrorism, what you see again and again is, yes, they have tons and tons of data, so they can figure things out after the fact. They can figure out the Times Square bombing, or they can figure out the Boston Marathon bombing. But it doesn't prevent them. It doesn't stop it from happening. What it does instead is give you something in retrospect. But there's a deeper issue. And the deeper issue is the national security state and the militarization of our society makes us less safe in the world, not more safe. So the fact that we have hundreds and hundreds of foreign bases, military bases around the world, doesn't make us a safer country. We would be better off if we would close the Pentagon and shut down every foreign military base and begin to live like a nation among nations.
Now, I want to ask you about the fact that actually Bill Ayers is an advocate of educational reform. So the notoriety that you've had, an unrepentant terrorist, all these headliners, has that helped you to advocate for education reform, or has it just meant that people won't listen to the educational reformer when they see you?
The fact is, I've never seen my life bifurcated in the way that you were kind of describing. I've never thought of it that way. I've seen my life as one consistent life. When I was 18, 19 years old, the kind of commitments and passions that ignited inside me then are the same ones that exist right now. I'm now 68 years old, so I'm 50 years older than I was then. But it's the same things that motivate me. It's the same things that get me out of bed in the morning. It's the same hopefulness that we don't have to live in this fractured, broken world, but we could create a better world. And education has always been part of how I've imagined that.
But and Virginia Woolf said the personal is political.
Very important.
So you must have a sense in which your personality is part of your toolkit.
I think the personal is political, and I think she was absolutely right about that. I also think, you know, when they founded Bloomsbury and Virginia Woolf said, everything is up for grabs, everything is for experimentation, everything is on trial, that's also guided me, that notion that you can't accept the common sense of what's right in front of you. You have to imagine a world that could be otherwise. And if you look even blinkingly at American history, you see the people who actually brought us forward as a people, who brought progress to human beings, who created a more just and peaceful and joyful society, were always the dissidents, always the radicals, always the people who were building fire from below. It never came from the top. So you think of Lyndon Johnson, who passed the most far-reaching civil rights legislation since Reconstruction, wasn't part of the Black Freedom Movement. Franklin Roosevelt wasn't part of the labor movement, and Lincoln never belonged to an abolitionist party. Those three are remembered for those great events, partly because of fire from below. That's all I'm interested in. I'm interested in ordinary people insisting on organizing themselves and creating a better world for all of us.
Bill Ayers talking there to FSN's Daniel Wrenches. The book is called Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident, and it's published by Beacon Press. And that concludes this edition of FSN Reports. On Monday, we'll be back with our more regular diet of news and features from FSN's bureaus worldwide. That's on Monday, but for now, I'm Simon Marks. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.